What's the date today? March something.
March 17th.
And it's St. Patrick's Day.
No wonder you knew it off the top of your head like that. It is March 17th, and we are getting close to the end of the book of Judges, but we haven't finished it yet. We're in chapter 20 of 21 chapters, in the midst of this second of a double conclusion. Just as there was a double intro to the book, there's a double conclusion. These two conclusion stories are not pleasant ones. I've said multiple times there are no good guys in these stories. But they are demonstrating the extent to which Israel had wandered away from the path that God had laid down for them, and how much they had wandered away from him as their God. If the story in chapter 17 and 18 about this man Micah, who had all the household idols and stole the money from his mother and then gave it back, and part of it was used to make another image or two, carved image and a metal image, and made his own ephod and had his own form of worship and was worshiping at least probably Yahweh, but almost certainly other gods as well. So he was blending religions. If you know the history of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, blending religions is a thing that our church gets really exercised about. Don't do that. Syncretism, we call it. And then you also had this faction from the tribe of Dan that decided, look, we can't conquer the land God told us to conquer, so we're going to go find some easier spot to take. And they did, way up north from where they were supposed to be. And along the way, they stole Micah's household idols and his carved and metal image. And they even stole the priest he'd hired to be his own little household priest. And they all went up north and settled there after they had taken a city that they probably weren't supposed to take, certainly in a way that they weren't supposed to take it. I mean, nothing in this story happens the way it's supposed to happen, according to the instructions God gave them for living in the land. And it just shows the breadth of how things had gone wrong and permeated the society. You had a Levite who wasn't doing what he was supposed to. You had a citizen who wasn't doing what he was supposed to. You had an entire faction of a tribe that wasn't doing what it was supposed to. It affected the religious life. It affected the household life. It affected the military life. And then in chapters 19, 20, 21, we have the story that we're in the midst of now, which shows the depth of this disobedience, disregard, and depravity. There, I found a little alliteration. I wasn't even planning on it. It's one of the harder stories to deal with, not because it's difficult, but because it's just so unpleasant. Where a Levite with a concubine, strike one, goes and gets her after they've had a falling out, goes and fetches her from her father's house, is taking her back up to the hill country of eastern Ephraim, where he lives, and they decide to spend the night. They need to spend the night somewhere on the way. They pass up Jebus, which would later become Jerusalem, because he doesn't want to stay in a foreign city. And instead, they make it just a few miles farther to Gibeah. So that expressly makes it clear to us as readers that Gibeah is a Hebrew town. Because otherwise, it might be easy to say, well, of course, what's going to happen next looks so much like Sodom and Gomorrah from Genesis 19, and it does. Because there were so many Canaanites still living in the land. Israel hadn't driven them out. So this is probably a city full of Canaanites. No. He passed by the city of Canaanites, specifically Jebusites, to get to a city that had Israelites. So this is Israelites who are committing this sin. But it is the same sin as the men of Sodom in Genesis 19. The city fails to show hospitality to the Levite, until finally a farmer coming in from the fields sees him late in the town square, which is a cultural custom we talked about for the sojourner looking for a place to spend the night. Hang out in the town square, somebody would show you hospitality. Nobody does until this farmer finally comes in late, takes them into his home, and then men of the city come and pound on the door and say, give us the stranger who's visiting you, because we want to commit unspeakable, perverted sexual acts upon him. And the Levite's no hero here either, nor necessarily is the farmer, because the farmer says, no, don't do this. I'll send my virgin daughter out. Thanks, Dad. And the Levite's concubine, and as it turns out, the virgin daughter doesn't play a role in the story, but the Levite sends his concubine out. And she is ravaged all night long, gang raped, and makes it back to the door, to the threshold, and dies. Next morning, the Levite finds her. The story doesn't make him look very good because he doesn't show any concern for her. He just basically says, get up, it's time to go. But she's dead. So he takes the body, takes it home, and dismembers it into 12 pieces and sends them out to the tribes. In what is not very well explained in the text, but given everything that happens afterward, there's really no other way to understand it, I think. He sent those parts out with some information as well to protest what had been done. And it would be great if it were a protest of what had been done to her. But when we hear the story he tells to the tribes when they respond and gather, he's really upset about what has been done to him in sense of his property and maybe the disrespect shown to him as a Levite. But it's all about him. And he leaves out a lot of the details that would make him look bad, like he needs help, when he explains everything that has gone on. And that's pretty much where we were through last week. The other tribes of Israel have gathered, and in Judges 20, we're down around verse 18 officially. The tribes of Israel have gathered at Mizpah, 400,000 strong. They sent word also to Benjamin, to the tribe of Benjamin, which is where all of this happened. Gibeah is a city of Benjamin. But the Benjaminites did not come and rally with the rest of the tribes. Instead, they decided that they were going to defend their city, Gibeah. So now you have all of the tribe of Benjamin, 26,700 strong, against all the other tribes, 400,000 strong. Their plan was to take Gibeah and destroy it, and they didn't need 400,000 people for that, so they're going to cast lots. Only every 10th person would go. They'd have an army 40,000 strong. The text tells us that before, it tells us that Benjamin decided that they weren't going to help, but that they were instead going to defend. So instead of 40,000 against the town of Gibeah, now it's 40,000 against almost 27,000. It's a lot more even odds if they, even odds, I hate to say that. It's a lot more equal odds if they go ahead and still do this one-tenth of the army idea. And they do go ahead and do that. So that's where we are. This incident where a city in Israel has descended to the depths of what happened in Sodom in Genesis 19, has now brought Israel to the brink of civil war. And even that is for the wrong reasons. So, Genesis 20, verse 18, the people of Israel arose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God, who shall go up first for us to fight against the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up first. Does that sound at all familiar? Do you remember reading words like that before? Because we have. Just as we've got this double conclusion to bookend with the double intro, this very dynamic, this very phrase, this very question exists at both ends of the book. When Israel began to go into the land, they went to Bethel and they inquired of the Lord and said, who shall go up first to begin taking the land that God has apportioned for us? And the Lord said to them then, Judah shall go up first. With one important difference. Back then, God said, Judah shall go up first. And you remember, then it tells the story of Judah taking the land, and they were very successful. But the successfulness of the various tribes' efforts falls off as we work our way through the tribes during those first couple chapters of Judges. Back then, God said, Judah shall go up first, for surely I have given the land into your hands. Now God says, Judah shall go up first. And what's missing is just as conspicuous as the parallel of what's there. He doesn't promise them victory. For the first time, he doesn't promise them victory. Verse 19. Then the people of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against the town of Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin. This would be 40,000 from Judah. And the men of Israel drew up the battle line against them at Gibeah. Verse 21, the people of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and destroyed on that day 22,000 men of the Israelites. God did not promise them the victory, and in fact, they didn't get the victory. Benjamin won the first battle of this. And 22,000 of the men of Israel fell, which would be 22,000 of the men of Judah, since Judah went forward first. But the people, the men of Israel, took courage and again formed the battle line in the same place where they had formed it on the first day. And the people of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until the evening. And they inquired of the Lord, shall we again draw near to fight against our brothers, the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, go up against them. So the people of Israel came near against the people of Benjamin the second day, and Benjamin went against them out of Gibeah the second day and destroyed 18,000 men of the people of Israel. Second combat, second battle, Benjamin wins again. All these were men who drew the sword, all 18,000. Then all the people of Israel, the whole army, went up and came to Bethel and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, ministered before it in those days. And I have to stop there parenthetically and say this is how we know that this didn't happen at the end of the time of the judges. Because the time of the judges, remember, spans three and a half centuries. But if Aaron's son Eleazar, his son Phinehas, if Aaron's grandson Phinehas is ministering at Bethel, it has not been 350 years since they entered the land. It's only been a generation, maybe two, since they entered the land. 300 years ago, I wasn't alive. My grandfather wasn't alive. So when we have this genealogy here, this is earlier in the time. But we've said all along, Judges is not entirely chronological. And these two stories at the end have been chosen and put at the end, not because they happened last, but because they most forcefully show the theme of the book, which is Israel's deterioration and falling away from God. So they've lost two battles against Benjamin. They go to Bethel, they fast, they make offerings, they pray, and they inquire of the Lord, saying, "Shall we go once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we stop?" And the Lord said, "Go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand." Finally, the third time, is God's promise that they will be victorious. And we can talk about why it takes three tries before God promises them victory. The text doesn't say. Personally, I think it's because this is not just a judgment against Gibeah, but it's a judgment against all of Israel. The other tribes are not living perfect lives either. The way the stories in the book are arranged, we have seen judges from all over the 12 tribes and the lands they were given, raised up by God to help the people when they had fallen away from God and had therefore fallen under the judgment of being oppressed by someone, typically a foreign oppressor. So none of them is doing what God has asked them to do. And I think this conflict within Israel is a judgment upon all of Israel to varying degrees. That's my opinion of why it takes three tries before God tells them that they will have the victory. And even that is a sad thing to say because of what's coming after this. But if you know the story, that's great. If you don't, you'll see what I mean soon. So they're going to go for it a third time. They have God's assurance this time. Verse 29, "So Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah. And the people of Israel went up against the people of Benjamin on the third day and set themselves in array against Gibeah as at the other times. And the people of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. And as at other times, they began to strike and kill some of the people in the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah, and as well began to kill them in the open country, about 30 men of Israel. And the people of Benjamin said, 'They are routed before us as at the first.'" This is going to be just like the last couple of encounters. "But the people of Israel said, 'Let us flee and draw them away from the city to the highways.' And all the men of Israel rose up out of their place and set themselves in array at Baal Tamar. And the men of Israel who were in ambush rushed out of their place from Mara Geba." And if I had a map, I couldn't help, because we don't know where these places were in at least some of the instances. "And there came against Gibeah 10,000 chosen men out of all Israel. And the battle was hard, but the Benjaminites did not know that disaster was close upon them." So Israel goes up just like they did before. And the battle starts out just like it did before. Benjamin has the early upper hand. And they think they know exactly how this script is written because they've already played it out twice. But Israel pulls back, which is not necessarily surprising if you've already lost with this tactic twice. Israel pulls back. Benjamin follows, but Israel has 10,000 men secreted away to cut in behind them. That's what's happening here in terms of the military strategy. That puts us at verse 35. And the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel. And the people of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day. All these were men who drew the sword. So the people of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. 25,100. How many did they have to start? 26,700. The 26,000 who were marshaled, but also the 700 left-handed specialist troops who could split a hare at 100 yards with a sling. So they had 26,700. They have at most 1,600 men left, if you do the arithmetic here. But probably less, because even though they won those first two encounters, it's unlikely that they were totally without casualties. But any way you figure the math, Benjamin has been almost completely wiped out. Verse 36, so the people of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. The men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin because they trusted the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah. Then the men in ambush hurried and rushed against Gibeah. The men in ambush moved out and struck all the city with the edge of the sword. Now the appointed signal between the men of Israel and the men in the main ambush was that when they made a great cloud of smoke rise up out of the city, the men of Israel should turn in battle. So we're kind of backing up now and getting another account of the battle with a little more detail as to how it played out. We already know how it ends. There are sort of two, one after the other, accounts of the battle here. So don't get confused. We've seen Scripture do this many times. There are two creation stories. There are two introductions to Judges. There are two conclusions to Judges. There are two stories about how this battle played out, and we just slid from one end to the other. This one just has more detail. So Israel has fallen back to draw Benjamin out. The men in ambush have gone in to destroy Gibeah. Benjamin had begun to strike, I'm in verse 39, and kill about 30 men of Israel, which was the exact number that was set up above a few verses. They said, surely they are defeated before us, as in the first battle. But when the signal began to rise out of the city in a column of smoke, the Benjaminites looked behind them, and behold, the whole of the city went up in smoke to heaven. That's a particular phrase. It's not just that the smoke was rising into the sky. Israel had dedicated Gibeah to be completely destroyed, just as they had done with some of the Canaanite cities. They didn't just kill any soldiers left in the city. There probably weren't any. They killed everyone and burned the city to the ground. That's the idea behind some of this language. Then the men of Israel turned, and the men of Benjamin were dismayed, for they saw that disaster was close upon them. Therefore they turned their backs before the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness. But the battle overtook them. And those who came out of the cities were destroying them in their midst. Surrounding the Benjaminites, they pursued them. Every once in a while, I don't like the English Standard Version. This sounds a little awkward. And trod them down from Nobah as far as opposite Gibeah on the east. "18,000 men of Benjamin fell, all of them men of valor. And they turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. 5,000 men of them were cut down in the highways, and they were pursued hard to Gidom, and 2,000 of them were struck down. So all who fell that day of Benjamin were 25,000 men who drew the sword, all of them men of valor." The other account said 25,100. And if you're going to hang your decision about how reliable Scripture is on how precisely military casualty estimates are, then there's a whole other conversation to be had. There is no problem with one version saying 25,000 and the other saying 25,100. One is more precise. That's all. But 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon and remained at the rock of Rimmon 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back against the people of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword, the city, men and beasts, and all that they found, and all the towns that they found, they set on fire. So Israel finally wins, but it takes 3 tries. And Benjamin is not just defeated, but they are routed. And Benjamin is not just routed, but they are nearly, truly annihilated. So, the tribe of Benjamin is on the verge of extinction. And I almost have to wonder, and I have no idea, this is just my speculation, but I almost have to wonder whether anyone on the opposing army, the other tribes of Israel, or the Levite who got this whole thing started, or anyone, at this point is saying, whoa, I didn't mean for it to go this far. I don't know. But as we're about to see, Israel collectively is very concerned about the fact that Benjamin is now almost annihilated. They see that as a problem. And it actually is a problem. Because if Benjamin is annihilated, why is that a problem? They're one of the 12 tribes, yeah. Take it farther. Yeah. Take the next step.
They're going to give you up the land.
Well, it isn't.
Mine has a footnote.
No, I don't want footnotes. I want you guys to think.
You know, is
go ahead, Gus.
David from the tribe of Benjamin?
No. Saul is. Saul will be. It's a little more general than that. What do you got? What do you got?
It says, had the tribe of Benjamin been totally wiped out, Saul, Esther, and Mordecai, and the apostle Paul would have never been born.
Fair enough, but God would have raised up other people to do the same things. So that to me isn't the obstacle. The obstacle is the promise of God. The obstacle is his word. He has given land to Benjamin. He has counted Benjamin among the 12 tribes. Well, Benjamin is one of the 12 tribes. If Benjamin is completely annihilated, then arguably God is not keeping his promise to part of Israel. Now, there's a counter argument to say, well, Israel isn't keeping its covenant with God either. And ultimately, centuries from now, Israel will be almost annihilated. But God has never completely turned his back on his people. Now, all that being said, I'll just give this away right now. The manner in which Israel decides to make sure Benjamin survives is no more praiseworthy than anything else we have seen in this story. So, let's see how they do it. Chapter 21. Now, the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, and this is important, you've got to pay attention to the vows that Israel has made here, because they're going to run into each other, these two vows. Now the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, no one of us, none of us, shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. They made a vow. None of us will give our daughters in marriage to Benjamin. And the people came to Bethel and sat there till evening before God. And they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, O Lord, the God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel, that today there should be one tribe lacking in Israel. Which isn't quite true, but it's on the verge of being true, because if there are only 600 men left in Benjamin, and we've all vowed that we're not going to give them our daughters in marriage, and the next day the people rose early and built there an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the people of Israel said, notice it does not say, and the Lord said. And the people of Israel said, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up in the assembly to the Lord? For they had taken a great oath, here's the second one, for they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. So they've got two vows. The first vow is, we're not going to give any of our daughters to marry Benjaminites. The second vow is, anybody who did not answer the call to come fight against Benjamin, we will put to death. And they're now going to use these vows against each other to figure out a way to save the tribe of Benjamin. So, hey, we made this great oath concerning anyone who didn't come up to the Lord to Mizpah, saying he shall surely be put to death. Who didn't come? And the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin, their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel this day. What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives? Verse 8, and they said, what one is, this is the same question again, what one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah? And behold, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. So it isn't a tribe, it's more of a clan, it's a town. But no one from Jabesh-Gilead came when they rallied everyone to come to Mizpah. For when the people were mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. So the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men there and commanded them, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword. Also the women and the little ones. This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman that has lain with a male, you shall devote to destruction. And of course, the implicit thing is there, spare the virgins. Verse 12, and they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. So, we made a vow at Mizpah that we would not give any of our daughters to the Benjaminites. But the people of Jabesh-Gilead weren't at Mizpah. So they didn't make that vow. So let's use their daughters. That's what is happening here. Can you believe it? That's what is happening here. They're using their vow to attack anyone who doesn't rally with them, to get around their vow that none of their daughters shall be given to marry Benjaminites. So now go and kill the people who didn't come to rally with us to fight Benjamin, and we'll use their daughters. Probably patting themselves on the back for this clever way of getting around one vow by the way you apply another. And it's just a huge reminder that there is a conversation to be had about the view of women in the book of Judges, which has the same descent down farther and farther into evil as everything else in the book. It gets worse. Verse 13. So they bring the 400 virgins back from Jabesh-Gilead to Shiloh. Then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin, who were at the rock of Rimmon, and proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned at that time. And they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead. But there were not enough for them. Remember, there were 600 Benjaminites. There are 400 virgins from Jabesh-Gilead. And the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. Then the elders of the congregations said, "What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin?" And they said, "There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe not be blotted out from Israel." I don't know what to think here. There's a part of me that says, no, you would not want a tribe blotted out from Israel, because that would have implications for whether God's promises were reliable. There's another part of me that says, God has already fulfilled his promises in the covenant. Nothing in this effort to save Benjamin is of the Lord. It's all Israel's thinking and scheming and cleverness. Maybe losing Benjamin would have been a really good lesson for the rest of the tribes in the generations to come. But probably not. Nothing really seemed to be able to teach them the lessons they needed to learn. But it is what it is. And what it is 11 tribes looking at 200 remaining Benjaminites and thinking, there's got to be something we can do. So verse 18, they don't want the tribe to be blotted out, yet we cannot give them wives from our daughters. For the people of Israel had sworn, "Cursed be he who gives a wife to Benjamin." So they said, "Behold, there is a yearly festival of the Lord at Shiloh, north of Bethel, on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebona. And they commanded the people of Lebanon, saying, "Go and lie in ambush in the vineyards and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, we will say to them, 'Grant them graciously to us, because we did not take for each man of them his wife in battle, neither did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty.'" In other words, they solve two-thirds of the problem by saying, "We'll kill the people of Jabesh-Gilead, because we vowed to kill anyone who wouldn't come and help us in the battle. And we'll use their virgin daughters as wives for the Benjaminites." And that solved two-thirds of the problem. So that way we don't have to give our daughters, because we promised we wouldn't. Now they're saying, yeah, I know, Greg, you're just sitting there shaking your head, and so am I. Now they're saying, okay, we promise not to give them our daughters, but if they take them, well, that's different. That's what's happening here. So they tell Benjamin, go hide in the fields during the festival, and if the virgins of Shiloh come out during the dance, snatch one, take her home, make her your wife. That way we didn't give them, Benjamin took them. This is exactly what's going on here. It is the most incredible hair-splitting finagling to try to get around the promise that they made that I've ever seen. Verse 23, And the people of Benjamin did so, and took their wives, according to their number, which means 200, from the dancers whom they carried off. Then they went and returned to their inheritance, rebuilt the towns, and lived in them. And the people of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. And they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. And if it wasn't clear already, and we haven't said it enough, let's just put the capstone on this whole pathetic story. Verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. In spades. Just the most incredible story.
Oh, Mr. Stanford?
Yes?
I have some questions in my Bible.
You don't have answers in your Bible? You just have questions?
Just the questions about judges.
Well, okay. Let's hold off on those, because not everybody's got the same questions in their Bibles. Ed?
Okay.
The most incredible, well, not most incredible, but one of the most incredible things about this is...
It's hard to pick a most incredible, but go ahead.
They chose to honor, of all the vows they made to God, they chose to honor the vow that they made to each other.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's
yes.
You know, God's right here. You make all these vows and then you break them. But the one they make between themselves that had nothing to do with God, that's the one they choose to honor.
Yeah. There is nothing to suggest that that vow about giving, not giving their daughters as wives to Benjamin, there is nothing to suggest that that was a vow made to the Lord.
You can almost hear Satan whispering in their ear, did God surely say? No, he didn't, but we can do this anyway.
Well, especially in the first of these two stories, there is a lot of echoes of the fall in Eden. Now there are a lot of echoes of Sodom and Gomorrah in the second story. Yeah, that all plays. They've decided to make their own rules. And make their own ways to get around their own rules. Because their own rules didn't work out quite the way they wanted them to. So, we have the time. Let's see if we can wrap up this study of Judges yet in our time left today. Because I don't know about you, but I'm ready to be done with the sad, sad stories in this book. These last two stories have been so dark that I have to remind myself that there are heroes in this book. There are. It starts out with Joshua talking to the tribes. Joshua was a hero. Othniel, the first judge, came out looking pretty good. But it's a slow decline in the quality of hero. It's a slow decline in the quality of the spiritual life that Israel lives. It's a slow decline in their relations with one another. It's a slow decline in their even remaining a nation that looks like what they were meant to look like. Remember that we've seen these indications, like in the story of Abimelech, or the stories, they're not really stories, the very tiny, hinted things that are said about judges for whom we have no story. Like Jair, who had 30 sons who rode 30 white donkeys and ruled 30 cities. You've got this structure that isn't really tribal. It's more of a sort of city-state federation. Abimelech rules an area that actually spans the eastern end of more than one tribe's territory. And they're defining the government by cities rather than tribe territories in many parts of the book. Why is that a problem? Because that's a very Canaanite thing to do. That is another way in which Israel was looking more and more like the Canaanites whom they were supposed to drive out of the land. So not only do they fail to drive the Canaanites out, In some cases, they allow the Canaanites to stay. In some cases, the Canaanites basically allow them to stay, because especially in some of the northern tribes, the efforts to conquer the land were so unsuccessful that the Canaanites still remained the majority. So they start to marry Canaanite women and presumably give their daughters in marriage to Canaanite men, adopt Canaanite customs, adopt Canaanite gods, and even adopt Canaanite governmental structures with these city-state structures throughout the land instead of the tribal boundaries that God set aside for them. To the extreme point that Dan has 600 men who say, you know what, we're not even going to stay inside the territory God marked out for us. And they go miles and miles and miles north, way up to the northern frontier. And they take a poor, peaceful, unsuspecting city up there from the Sidonians. And they make that their home. So that on maps of Israel, you often have Dan down here by Ephraim, and you have Dan way up there, way north of the Sea of Galilee. Because that northern one is the offshoot. In every imaginable way, Israel's life veers away from what God had laid out for them in Deuteronomy, in the second giving of the law. And if you read especially Deuteronomy 12, and I think 17, you'll see the contrasts between how they were supposed to live and how Judges shows them living. Judges starts with some very honorable women being depicted. Who was Othniel married to? Anybody remember? Really? Please? Nobody? Caleb's daughter. Othniel was Caleb's son-in-law. Caleb, one of the two spies who really believed that they could take the land. Caleb, one of the two spies who lived to see the land when everybody else in Israel was allowed to pass away in their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Aksa was her name. She's the first woman that we meet, and she's a very honorable woman. Strong of personality, has the foresight to make sure that the dowry she's given from her father Caleb is to her husband's advantage. Make sure that they get the springs, the water source for the land, because down in the south, water is a bigger issue than it is up in the north. Smart lady. We met Jael, the Hebrew wife of a Kenite who had moved up north with his many flocks. And even though her husband, with all of his material wealth and therefore all of his personnel, probably enough to make a small standing army of his own, even though he had a peace treaty with the Canaanite king up there, when God gave the victory to Israel over Sisera, and he fled, she finished the victory for Israel by putting a tent peg through his head while he slept. She's a hero of the story. It's the same story where Deborah is a hero because she's the judge. Judges starts out putting women in front of us who are very strong in their faith, who were willing to act on their faith, But then as the book goes on, we see the view of women deteriorate. Not from the author, but from the attitude within Israel itself toward women. You also had the anonymous woman who dropped that millstone and killed Abimelech. But then you start seeing instances where women are treated with less respect. And concubines are pushed out the front door to be ravaged and killed. Or virgins are set up to be kidnapped in the middle of a festival. And other instances through these last two stories where suddenly the view of women is far darker. And it's made clear that while women can play an honorable role in the plans of God, as we see in the first half of the book, that the nation of Israel increasingly sees women, is shown more and more to see women in a negative light, in an unimportant light, as if they're property, as if they're less important, expendable, as if they're just tools to be used. Save the 400 virgins, and that will be the tool with which we get around the vow that we made. Go lie in ambush for the virgins in the festival, and they will be the tool by which we find a way to satisfy our desire that Benjamin succeed. What kind of respect is that? It's not the respect that was given to Jael. An entire song was written about her and her role in the victory over Sisera. So that is one of the ways, and one I think worth talking about, which is why I have been, that we see the decline of Israelite civilization through the book of Judges. One clear thread that you can get hold of and pull all the way through the chapters is the view of women in Israel. Now, I understand that culturally in that time, women were not considered with the same honor that hopefully they would come to be later, and in more modern times, we have our own issues today with the way women are viewed in society. But you can't just use that as a way to dismiss Deborah or Jael or Aksa. These are women of honor. You can't use that and just write off, well, women weren't important in that culture. That's just the way it was. Now, women were always important in the heart of God. All the way back in Eden, when Adam went through the exercise of giving names to all the animals and finding out, you know what, this is actually really lonely. So God, teaching him how much he needed her, then gave him Eve. But Israel's view of women just spins down, just like every other part of their life. So, just one piece. The relations between the sexes, the spiritual life of Israel, even the political structure of Israel, all of it spins away from what God had told them in Deuteronomy he wanted them to do. In no fashion do they successfully live as the people of Yahweh. And the one mistake that we must not make as we turn away from the book of Judges and move now for the rest of this year into the book of Ruth, which is set at the same time, the one mistake we must not make is to look at all that and say, wow, I am sure glad it's not that bad now. Because it is just that bad now. It's not necessarily just that bad in the world around us. Sometimes it is just that bad within the Christian community too. So that we have a Roman Catholic cardinal sentenced to 6 years in prison because of the way he was treating children, sexually mistreating. We have rifts bubbling up in the Southern Baptist Convention because of hundreds of reports of pastors misusing their authority and their relationships with women in their churches. We have entire movements in Christendom that want to throw out the worship structures that the New Testament offers to us. Granted, it's not as rigid as the Old Testament, but they just want to throw it out and invent it all over again from scratch. We'll worship God in our own way. That sounds a lot more like Micah with his household idols than anything else. We have a lot of the same problems in 21st century garb that Judges has shows us. It's still there. And it's been there all in between. My favorite author, Annie Dillard, said something in the book Holy the Firm that has always stuck with me, and teaching the book of Judges has made me think of it over and over and over and over again, but I've refrained from sharing it until now. There is a line in that book where Dillard says, "There is no greater evidence of the unending mercy of God than the continued existence of his church on earth." Because we mess it up, and this is now me talking, not Dillard, because we mess it up in so many ways that it's a wonder he lets us survive. And that's how I come out feeling out of Judges. Israel messes everything up on every single front in so many ways. It is a wonder that he lets them survive. But we must not look at that and think, boy, I'm glad that's not me. That is us. We have the same problems, sometimes individually, always collectively. We have the same problems, and we are just as desperately in need of the mercy of God for our continued survival, because we're no better than these Israelites for all of the ugly stuff that we have seen in these 21 chapters. We are no better than these Israelites. And thanks be to God that his mercy can extend that far beyond what I can possibly comprehend that he should tolerate. That is a love for me that I cannot comprehend. That's the lesson from Judges. Not how awful Israel was. And not even, although it's an important piece of it, how awful we can be, but how infinite God's love and mercy is, that he should provide for us in spite of it. Now in 1 Samuel, he will begin to provide. He will give them the king they need to pull them together. That won't work all entirely either, but that's another book, another year, another set of lessons. Let me stop there with a couple of minutes left and ask you if you have any thoughts here as we wrap up. Elmer.
Lots of different things you can point out in here. One that kind of stuck out for me.
I'm going to say pick two because we're our time's limited. Go ahead.
You don't want. The Levites were the ones that were the priesthood, and the priesthood was provided for by God, that they had different cities and that they got their income from. They had the direction points and gates of the city where they'd give of their first fruit to help support the Levites and all that.
Yes.
As they went away from the true God, they started setting up all these different gods. That started to dilute the people that were giving to God. So therefore, the support of the priesthood went down financially quite a bit. Then you come along and they started having these epochs they had put around different places, which is representative of a priest. Instead of, you got a problem, go into a priest, you can just kind of go and deal with it right there. It's about like, you got a question, you go to Google it, and he'll tell you what to do. So they've taken God out of the picture altogether. It's easier to give whatever you want to a fake God than your 10% to the real God. So everything went down. So you've got these priests that are the only ones that are knowledgeable, can read and write and everything. Everybody else, basically, illiterate. Maybe some can, but not probably over 90% of the school countryside camp.
All right.
So there's no one to say, hey, you're going off the beaten path. Get back on the beaten path. So they've corrupted the whole country by getting away from God and the people who are the voice of God, which are the priests. So I'm thinking there's a big thing there of a failure of the people to keep the priest viable so they can live and everything else to get out. And then they are basically homeless. These two guys we're talking about in here, my way of looking at it, they're homeless. They're out roaming the countryside wherever they could go.
We're not given a real clear explanation, but I tend to agree with you as far as those Levites in the last two stories. Maybe not so much the second one, because he was headed home to Ephraim, so he had a home. But the first one, he appears to have been an unemployed Levite. Well, that's not supposed to happen. But if they're turning away to foreign gods, then, yeah, they're probably not tithing. The Levites are not getting the support that they're supposed to, and it makes it tough. I agree. That is one facet of the deterioration of the fabric of the society. Yeah. No argument on that. Anyone else? You just want the snacks. Okay. I will probably think of something between now and next week about Judges, just in retrospect, that I'll hit then if that proves true. I'm notorious for that, as you know. But by and large, we're going to turn our attention toward the book of Ruth now. And it'll be a little more pleasant. And an intentional contrast to Judges. The difference between God's toleration and correction versus God's blessing. Let's pray. Father, as we end this book of Judges, I think we all feel relief in one sense because it has become so dark. But please let us not forget the lessons that are here for us. Please let us not fail to see our reflection in this story. And most importantly, please help us realize, however much we can in our limited finitude, the infinite nature of your mercy and grace, that you love us in spite of the fact that we act this way, and that we often ignore you this much. Grant that we would turn towards you out of gratitude. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.